the schools of thought differed very strongly. We find that the Calcutta school primarily belonged to the classical Freudian school of thought, whereas we find Bombay to come up with very structured Tavistock model, which they've been following for a very long time. And in Delhi, we find the Ericksonian model. And the interesting part is also because of the availability of these cities and their connection to different parts of the world.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Juma Basak. Dr. Basak is a training and supervising psychoanalyst at the Indian Psychoanalytic Society in Calcutta, where she lives and works. Dr. Basak is an active member of the IPA's Committee on Women and Psychoanalysis and is a consultant member of the IPA's Humanitarian Committee. Her areas of interest in psychoanalysis are culture, women, and gender, and her publications have been translated into many languages, Japanese, Hungarian, Spanish, German, and she has presented papers at IPA congresses over the past decades. As you will hear in today's conversation, Dr. Basak describes two transformations, one culturally and one internally. And they both have to do with changing from an authoritative position that uses certainty and morality to deal with conflicting and complex inner feelings to one that really attends to the inner life of the other, in this case, the analyst, and also her own inner life. It's a lovely transformation. It's gracious and courageous of her to share it with us. And I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Basak as I have. Juma, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you here. Juma, I hadn't appreciated many aspects of psychoanalysis in India. I hadn't known about the theoretical differences between the major cities. I hadn't known about this entity called colonial hangover, which you'll explain to us at some point, about the change in theory before and after colonial rule. And most pointedly, it seems to me, is I hadn't known that there's been such a dramatic shift in the field from being one of profession of men to being a profession of women, which I can only imagine has all kinds of implications. But before we get to that, give us a glimpse of life in Calcutta, if you would. What life was like before COVID, what life is like now, and then we can discuss what life is like in psychoanalysis in Calcutta, where you live and work.
Right, Harvey. Firstly, thank you so much for engaging me in this conversation. It's an absolute pleasure and honor. And I will try to respond to what you say with as much understanding I have. So to come to what you said about life in Calcutta before the COVID situation, I think to sum up very simply about life in Calcutta or life in general in India, there's one word which is kind of, you know, like a fountain springs up, which is chaos. I think life in Calcutta or semblance of life that we experience is actually the sense of chaos around us. So in a very strange way, I think the city feels in a way enveloped with chaos, which both adds as an defensive protective measure, and also maybe acts as something that we can't get out of. So the COVID situation, bringing about the lockdown situation, had a direct impact on this aspect of chaos. And I think in this relation, I would also like to say that chaos in the Indian situation, Calcutta, needs to be understood with the Indian cultural, I would say, a sense of community life. So with the COVID situation and with the lockdown situation, this community life had a direct impact. And I believe, of course, it did all across the world. But when a society is, you know, its introduction, its identity becomes chaos and community-based society, then this kind of a and impact has a very overt, I would say, effect. And it felt as if one could visually see death around. Mm. That chaos, that life which was around, just became vacuum. And that it was just the essence of death around. And I think what happened with the gradual breaking down of the lockdown situation was a desperate attempt for people to get back to that community bonding, to that chaotic existence, because that is the essence of life, primarily. But of course, in this context, it is also important to remember that India has a very, very complex socioeconomic structure. So there are various reasons why this need to get back to life, because it for more than half the population, which is still under, one would say, poverty level, there is an absolute, earnest effort to get back to dire existence. So I think this is how I would like to share, you know, the complex.
Do I understand you right when you say the lockdown is no longer in place, or it's no longer in force?
It is in force, but it is contradictory at times, because on one hand, in terms of governmental norms and medical norms, there is a lockdown, and there's a gradual breaking down of the lockdown happening. Some states and some cities are maintaining it very strongly. But overall, it is very difficult, probably, for the Indian situation to maintain that kind of very strict lockdown mode, which we perhaps have seen and read a little in Italy or in England to some extent.
Do people wear masks?
They do. They do. Yes, we do see outside when we walk out that everybody is wearing a mask, which is very different visually from the pre-COVID situation. Very unusual, but has become quite a regular feature. Mm-hmm. but it's more because of a norm that one has to wear a mask, not because so much of an awareness or consciousness.
Okay. And tell us about the psychoanalytic life in Calcutta.
To begin with, very briefly, I think it's fair that I touch upon this note of the birth of psychoanalysis in India. Otherwise, yes, we may not quite understand the rift which has happened later. That takes us, the birth of psychoanalysis in India was in Calcutta in 1922. That was when the Indian Society was established. But to talk about that, one actually needs to see something that we called the Bengal Renaissance. Just a while back, you talked about the colonial hangover. So yes, the term itself can give you an idea that the Bengal Renaissance was in spirit talking about the various educational, intellectual, social reforms that Bengal as a state, Calcutta, was had gone through in the 19th century. And when we look at the development of psychoanalysis by Girindra Shekhar Bose, who's considered as the father of psychoanalysis in India, which happened in Calcutta, that intellectual flavor actually comes from that, as a residual flavor of that period of the Bengal Renaissance. So after this period, after the 20s, when there has been so much of, the Bengal Renaissance in at the same time with the 20s, going with so much of changes and so much of happening, Calcutta, possibly, as I would say, I don't know how to put it in best way, but maybe experience something one would call as an intellectual stagnation post the fountain of psychoanalysis that happened in Calcutta at that time. And I would like to consider, I'm not sure, that intellectual stagnation may be related to the huge intellectual exodus, as I would say, to the West in the 40s, 50s, 60s that happened in India, in Bengal. And it may have an impact. I'm not very sure about it, but I would like to tend to think along those lines. And in this interim period, what we see is that psychoanalysis from Calcutta was finding other metropolitan cities who are becoming vibrant, and Calcutta may have been steeped with its own crisis, socioeconomic and cultural complexities, whereas we find the commercial city like Bombay and the capital city like New Delhi kind of coming up with the psychoanalytic schools. And here, of course, the schools of thought differed very strongly. We find that the Calcutta school primarily belonged to the classical Freudian school of thought, whereas we find Bombay to come up with a very structured Tavistock model, which they've been following for a very long time. And in Delhi, we find the Ericksonian model. And the interesting part is also because of the availability of these cities with and their connection to different parts of the world, because Erickson did happen to visit north of India and I believe also in Delhi. Bombay, being the commercial city, had more, I would say, economic foundation to have international relations, whereas with Calcutta, with its very strong, I would say, intellectual, cultural growth, which was challenged because of the so-called exodus that happened, was almost left the ruins, the residual ruins of a very, very intellectually stimulating period. So that's probably how I would tend to see the spread of psychoanalysis in the three different metropolitan cities in the last couple of decades.
And how large of a psychoanalytic community is there in India?
I think currently it's compared to the country, it is very, very limited. I think we have about 35 members all across India, and we have lately a growing number in the candidates, I think 25 and more.
And describe the shift from being a male profession to a female profession. I'm intrigued about how that happened and the implications of that.
I think of course, it's very interesting once again to see the dichotomy of India. On one hand, very, very patriarchal in its you know, values, in its I think daily existence. But at the same time, the last couple of decades have seen women becoming more and more articulate and vocal about their rights, mm-hmm. about their claims, and I think that is quite a dichotomous position for India. But looking at the psychoanalytic community, I think it may be because when we started with the development of psychoanalysis, it was a pioneering motion, and the pioneering action or the motion was, I think, you know, willy-nilly, something that the male was giving leadership at that time pertaining to the patriarchal structure. But once that was established, if we see the clinical space, which is sadly even till date, has more female members, so more women visiting than male members of the community. And I think this entire analytic community kind of opened up to the women in this capacity and their persuasion to claim themselves, to voice their rights. Maybe this became a platform for them to be able to bring that about. Also, I think what I would once again tend to relate to that psychoanalysis in the 20s, when Bose had just initiated, it was actually being taught to a certain extent in the regular academic curriculum of the psychology program at the university level, which lost its significance and was almost silently washed away post Bose for a very long period. It is still there now.
I was just wondering, is it coming back in the university now? Because it is around the world and various right. programs right. are introducing analysis, yes.
Right. So it is there in the psychology program, but almost a negligible presence, though the demand from the students is increasing lately. But going back to the point of, that this aspect was open to the students, and we, in that phase of, let's say, post-20s, still about 70s, 80s, I think women were still looking at higher studies and had more access to this kind of knowledge, whereas I think the male member of the society would be primarily taken up by running the household and breadwinning. So there could be a possibility of that, because I would once again tend to believe, because that's how I guess I look at it, that all these are socio-culturally and socio-economically related in the Indian structure. Mm-hmm. And I think the shift from the male psychoanalytic dominance to the female psychoanalytic dominance could be located in this junction. But also I would like to point out is that theoretical speculations, running of the administration, all of this, which entailed authoritarian control, would be in the hands of the male members of the society. But when we look at clinical work, that was almost being shifted gradually to women. And once again, I tend to think that perhaps women are more into, the cleansing of the society, keeping the society intact, keeping the society functional. And I think here also the role of women in the Indian cultural scenario, the all-sacrificing caregiver, the mother, I think that kind of fitted in very well with the clinical practice of therapy.
Are you saying that the structure of the training programs, that is the politics of it or the authority of it, is still in the hands of men, or that too is shifting?
That is shifting. I think the Indian society, for the first time, I think, had a woman as their president of the society. So it is shifting hands. The position is shifting. Yes, yes.
And with this shift from men to women, has been a shift in theoretical sensitivity or approach or a change in thinking?
I would definitely like to believe that, but I also would like to say that this is a very critical and challenging position for all of us women, because if we are not very careful and self-reflective of the ways, even the administrative ways, that has continued in the Indian society for so many decades, we may unknowingly carry on with the same authoritarian principle voice, not just only in the administrative actions, but also maybe our theoretical positions. And that is, I think, alarming for the development of psychoanalysis itself.
Which is a lovely segue for me to invite you to share some clinical material where you have made your own evolution in thinking.
Right.
So do you want to give us a taste of how you've evolved in your clinical work?
I don't know whether I can claim it to be evolution, but definitely a very strong shift in my thought process.
Okay.
So this particular case where I've been working with this person for last couple of years, I think 5-6 years now, and I remember one of without going into a lot of details.
It's disguised, of course.
So I remember one of the most challenging aspects that I had to deal with, and where the shift happened with me, was he was married with children, and more than 10 years of marriage with a wife, and very well settled with his work. Wife was working, liberal-minded person, very well educated, highly qualified. So one of the challenging aspects that I came across in the initial period was his compulsive nature for sexual exploration with other women, at times with getting paid sex, at times just getting into some kind of an inner physical proximity, intimacy, so that he can have his sexual satisfaction, and then having nothing to do with the lady, or at times exploring massage parlors for sexual gratification. Now, I remember for a very long time, I think a few years, and I'm extremely, I feel sad about it, and what it must have felt for him, because I had this notion that, I had to correct this in him. And if this kind of compulsion, he's absolutely not analyzable, he's not analytic material at all. And today, when I reflect, I feel very disturbed that in my unconscious transference, counter-transference exchanges, I'm sure this has come about. And I find that to be a very, very moralistic and corrective position that the analyst was holding. I would say almost close to an authoritarian position, where I had to cleanse him of all this dirt. And over the years, I think my shift happened, and I I wanted to understand him with all of these aspects of his, and in a much more inclusive manner rather than in an eliminating process. And that actually took me to look at the other aspect of his life and personality, where his growing up has been in the rural areas. And in his association, how often he has talked about how embarrassed he has been, how ashamed he has been of this lineage of him, talking about the dirty toilet, the potholes like that, not really a toilet structure like as such. And I was beginning to kind of see that all of this may have something to do with each other, and I need to look at them in a holistic, inclusive manner to understand him, where this is coming from, what sexuality means to him, what women mean to him. Maybe he hates women, maybe he really finds women very dirty, as dirty as maybe the feces that collects in the pot. And that kind of changed my quality of exchange with him, and I believe that both of us experienced a different connection altogether.
It's a lovely description. You describe really two themes: the external community change from an authoritative position to a introspective position, if you will. You also describe the same thing happening inside your mind with this, in this analytic dyad, where you took the authoritative position, which kept you from listening to him and to listening to you. And you, I like the word evolved, you evolved into a perspective of hearing him as a person and hearing you as a person. Mm-hmm. And I assume these various facets were played out in the transference between the two of you, yes?
Yes, yes. And in my counter-transference reflections, I also realized, which we tend to look down upon perhaps once again from my model of, authoritarian model perhaps, but what capacity he had in his capacity to give itself for all those years, intuitively, he was giving me time to evolve.
What a nice perspective. Yeah, yeah. Our patients are kind to us, unknowingly. Yeah, yes, right, yes. Right. Yes. And how is he doing now? Where do things stand?
I think we are in a good spot now. I think there is much more of acceptance and evolution in his work and thoughts. And I think he's freer with sexuality. I think more and more in the sessions it's coming out, yes.
Yeah, that's lovely. Let me ask you, you're a spokesperson. Tell me if I have this right. You're a spokesperson for this change in psychoanalysis in Calcutta, if not India. What is it like for you to speak up like this? I mean, to really call out the history and to invite people to share in moving forward like you are?
I'm very nervous because I'm not sure if I'm saying the right thing and how it will be accepted.
That's true for all of us always, I think, right? but more so for you, because you're going out on a limb. Many go out on limbs, but you're going against the grain or the history. Is that a fair way to say it?
I think I wouldn't like to claim all of the history. I'm sure others are doing in their own capacity. But it does make one feel very professionally vulnerable within the community. Yes.
And how have you been received, and how has this perspective been received by the community?
I think firstly, I would like to say there is no platform where such aspects can be discussed in a structured manner or in an open-minded manner. It is yet to be formed with our community of analysts in India. With due respect and dynamism between each other, I think that good faith needs to develop, professional good faith needs to develop within ourselves, and not who is right and who is wrong. I feel very apprehensive about that and saddened, deeply saddened.
Because you feel that there's still these tensions between different ways of thinking, old and new?
Yes, I think we are too comfortable in our authoritarian positions. It gives us certainty. And we are all very, very apprehensive to lose certainty and start afresh on, you know, fresh grounds.
And maybe even more so today in this pandemic of uncertainty.
Absolutely.
About our health, about our future, about the economies, about the politics.
So true.
It's understandable, though, as you say, saddening that all of us are tempted to grab onto certainties. Juma, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for sharing as much as you have with us, for teaching me and our audience about life in India now, especially the psychoanalytic life, but for even more so for sharing your vulnerability as you have grown as an analyst, as we all grow, but we often don't share it on podcasts heard around the world. When one changes and becomes more attuned, it's more private, but you've been gracious enough to share it and teach us in the process. And I'm appreciative for your openness and your courage in doing so.
Thank you so much, Javi. Thank you.
I wish you all the best, and I want to thank you for accepting my invitation to speak to us.
Thank you, Javi. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity and guiding me through this. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. We can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.